Good morning. Well, no week on Playback seems to be complete without yet another instalment in the ongoing saga that is foreign travel. Stay and spend, courtesy of our shiny new stimulus package, or pandemic be damned, I've got to get out of this place. Well, this week saw the publication of the Green List, the countries to which we may travel, should that travel be deemed essential. But it was a list that threw up more questions than answers. On Wednesday's Drive Time, Philip Boucher-Hayes spoke to Ciarán Mulligan, Managing Director of Blue Insurance.
Would it be more prudent and, frankly, safer for everybody to just call the whole thing off and write off 2020?
No, because you've a whole travel industry that's suffering and on their knees at the moment. I mean, you've got travel agents, you've got tour operators, you've got airlines out there that are really suffering. And no matter what level you put in here, you know, some people will still not go on a staycation. And I understand people, you know, we want to support the Irish economy, but some people will not go on a staycation in Ireland. And you've people out here that have holiday homes abroad that could be that could fly out there and they could be staying there for a week and they would be safe, just as safe as going to Kerry. So if I was in control of the department, I would be changing this. I wouldn't have actually announced green corridors without changing to the high degree of caution which the Taoiseach had said yesterday. And I think this needs to be done in the next 24 hours. Otherwise, we're going to have people who will travel, and 50,000 are travelling every week at the moment, who don't have insurance cover.
Yeah, but you have just talked about people already taking holidays and being allowed to take holidays when the advice is no non-essential travel whatsoever.
Well, people still want to head away. The weather here, you know, people have different reasons for travelling abroad, whether they have a holiday home or whether they're friends or whether they're family, whether they're going to. So there's different reasons for people going abroad. I personally was due to go to France next week. I'm not going, but I'm going to the Greek islands in September. So, you know, the sooner the government release this and open it up to a high degree of caution, people who are travelling, 99% of people who are travelling abroad are going to be safe. And they'll probably be safer than they are in Ireland.
Well now, Ciarán, off to Greece, are we? Not so fast.
How can you justify, how can anybody justify going anywhere when the government's message is no non-essential travel? And I'm sorry, Ciarán, but your holiday in Greece isn't essential.
No, but then don't open up green corridors. If you're saying I have just as much a chance of getting an infection rate in Cork or Kerry than I have in one of the Greek islands, then don't open up the green corridors if that is your view.
Ciarán Mulligan of Blue Insurance, and I suspect he won't be alone in that way of thinking. But Philip also asked this travel expert for his take on the list.
Owen Curry, are you confused?
Very confused. This looks like a green list of countries that was designed not to work, Philip. We expected the ENFIT standard to be contested when government, they would say all the countries that have lower infection rates than Ireland, they qualify. They're also a European standard of about 20 over the last per 100,000 over the last 14 days that most of the rest of Europe is effectively using. I would have expected the decision last night to have come somewhere in the middle, but instead we got a very strange list of countries. Somebody I was talking to in the inbound tourism industry today said he thought he was at the draw for the World Cup.
Drive Time on Wednesday. Yesterday, however, Taoiseach the Leo Varadkar came into Sarah McInerney, and this is how he put it.
I think the advice may not be simple, but it is clear. And this is the advice. The government is saying to you that the safest thing to do is to stay at home, to not travel and holiday at home in Ireland this year. But if you are travelling, there are two sets of countries. For those on the green list, we're saying to you, you take normal precautions. And that means you don't need to restrict your movements for 14 days when you come back. For those countries not on the green list, the no non-essential travel advice still applies. And if you come back from there, then you must restrict your movements for 14 days.
But then they got into a tussle and a tangle over semantics.
You don't think this is confusing? Because I'm now confused. I don't know, because on the one hand you were telling me...
I don't think it's simple, but I don't think it's confusing.
Is there a difference between simple and confusing?
Simple is a one-liner, and a simple answer would be you can travel anywhere and it's fine, or you shouldn't travel anywhere. Yeah. But that wouldn't be honest and accurate advice, because there is a difference. There actually is a difference between a country that has a level of coronavirus that is lower than ours and a country where it's an epicenter or hotspot. So
right,
that's why we are giving different advice.
The virus doesn't know if you're going on essential travel or non-essential travel. So I might just ask you once more time, just for clarity. And I don't think you're trying to avoid the question, but I'm just not clear on what the answer is. Because can you go to the green list countries for non-essential travel? Is that the government advice?
You can. And when you return, you're not required to restrict your movements for 14 days. However, the government is saying that the safest thing to do is not to travel for any reason.
So you can, but you shouldn't?
No, you can, but the safest thing to do is to stay in Ireland, to holiday at home in Ireland, and not to travel off the island for any reason, essential or not. The safest thing to do is to stay at home.
Dancing a jig on the head of a pin that was Tánaiste the Leo Varadkar with Sarah McInerney yesterday. Over on Bio Regan, Sinead Ní Uachtaráin was happy to stay at home, if only she could find it.
Near has to go and lick into the country. Gur culture me, agus narev fis machurum agum, agus nach viat in tacht an ort. Agus willisagat cad a vi mar reilt olish. Suspire.
Aspire.
Inspire.
Oh my god.
Chnuk wham inspire. Chit derir chéile nur vis a shul. Agus vis agum.
Follow that star.
The Ride of Adolescence by Beowyn Regan, Jess Aaron. The Wild Laughter is the new novel from Keelan Hughes, and she spoke to Oliver Callan on Tuesday about the sibling relationship at the core of the book.
There's five children in the family, and I just think sibling relationships are just the most fascinating relationships. I can't really ever see myself not writing about family dynamics. I'll try. At a certain point, I'll try and write a novel just about friends. but they fascinate me because they're the relationships that are, you know, probably going to last the longest in your life.
Yeah.
But they're often the same. You know, they don't evolve. They get stuck at a certain point. And you are always a caricature of yourself to your sibling. And if they manage to evolve and become something new over time, like, that's really special. And then the love probably involved is really deep and unique and incomparable, you know, to another kind of love. So I find those dynamics always just really compelling.
Now, the novel is set on a potato farm in Roscommon, and there are dogs, not necessarily the cute, fluffy city dogs, more gnarly creatures with a lean and hungry look.
Hart, the protagonist, is scared of dogs. And this is, it's funny, I was scared of dogs when I was growing up, and, you know, we had to cycle to school every day, and my older sister would always cycle in front, protecting me from the dogs, you know,
right.
Because really they ran around the place, you know, and you could just expect to be chased on your bike every day.
Yeah.
So that was part of our upbringing.
And I
didn't really have any bad experiences. My brother was attacked by a dog, and I think it kind of, the dynamic with the landscape to me was, I felt that I was being accommodated by the landscape, but I wasn't in control of it. That it was someone else or some other, you know, kind of vibrancy was in control of the landscape. But I thought it would be interesting to give that fear to a man, particularly of somebody who grew up on a farm, because they're supposed to be a master of their environment.
Yes.
Or we expect them to be. And so it challenges masculinity in a very kind of basic way, but a way that kind of impacts him enormously.
Oh, peddling for your life with hot sheepdog breath on your bare ankles. 'Tis well we know it. That was Keelan Hughes with Oliver Callan. And on Liveline, there was a distinctly canine theme running through much of the week. It started on Monday with the cost of bringing the dog to the hotel. Not cheap. And then, all of a sudden, it segued into gentle criminality.
I mean, €40 for a dog that's not even going to eat anything out of the place, because I would have been bringing my own food for him anyway.
Do many hotels accept dogs like that? And would they?
No.
Can, no, so it's...
No,
we,
no.
That's why
there's
you That's why
hotels.
You tried this one, yeah.
Yeah, I always went to this one.
We have a little dog as well. We take him with us. He's small. We stick him in the bag and we stick him in the hotel.
Well, it might be a great idea to be telling any prospective hoteliers you're going to be sneaking a dog in your bag.
Yeah.
Liveline on Monday with Katie Hannon. But on Wednesday, dog stories took a darker turn when Sarah phoned in with a truly frightening story of when good dogs go bad.
We were in the kitchen and I had the two back doors open. So it was a lovely day. Max was on the right-hand side of the step and Caelan was crawling out. And we were watching because Caelan, he's not long crawling, but it's trying to get down off the step is still a bit of a hazard for him. So we were watching him because he was going down. He was just passing Max and just like that, completely unprovoked, no snarl, no bark, nothing. And people have said to me, oh, the dog must have been asleep. The dog was not asleep. Max was watching him. He was looking at him. And for whatever reason, he just grabbed him.
And did he leave a mark? How
he pierced. Okay? He's okay. He did. He's left marks on the top of his head. There's one. He was pierced a good bit. It's quite deep. And then his eye is swollen. We were so lucky he didn't lose his eye. And he's just cut and bruised and that. But like he's fine. He's on a course of strong antibiotics for the week, and he had to get a tetanus as well.
He must. I mean, just at that moment, he must have been very distressed.
Do you know what? It's not even the vision of what happened. It's the sound. I'll never forget the sound. It was horrible. I thought Max was going to kill him.
Oh, an absolutely dreadful experience. And Sarah's call prompted other people to bring us these stories. Here's Deirdre.
You can't trust a dog. You know, I ended up in hospital. I could have lost my arm now. I was really bad. I was in Navan Hospital, and Navan Hospital couldn't do enough for me. And then I had to go on to St. James's in Dublin. I didn't know the dog. I was just out walking, Katie, for a walk. I had a bag in my hand. I don't know what, I had a bag in my hand. And maybe he was after that bag. Maybe he had an apple or something in. I don't know what had in the bag. But he obviously went for the bag. I tried to get him off me and he grabbed me. I just threw the bag away. Only that I grabbed his tail. I gave him, only for that, he had me arm in a lock and I couldn't get him off me.
What kind of a dog was this, Deirdre?
He was a Labrador dog. Oh. And only that I squeezed him. And that was the only way that I got him off me. Only for that, he would have taken the whole arm off me.
And then Damien spoke to Katie. And steady yourself for this one.
We used to visit our grandparents on weekend. And myself and my brother, I was only 4 at the time. My brother was 6. We were just playing up the farm yard and we came down, walking into the house, and the collie dog was still at the back door. And just as we walked in around him, he just turned and dived on me. And he ended up ripping my top lip off and ripping my top right-hand eyebrow off. I rushed straight to hospital, and in fairness to Sligo Hospital, they've done a terrific job in attaching my lip and my eyebrow back on again.
They actually had to attach your lip and your eyebrow.
Yeah, my lip, even I suffered for years with my lip, used to swell up, and when I was 12, I went to, they brought me in to see what was wrong, and actually there was a dog here was still in it and was infecting it every so often.
Okay.
Ooh, nasty, desperate stuff. That was Liveline on Wednesday. And later, that same day, Brenda Donoghue was sitting in for Ray Darcy, and she spoke to Dr. Michelle Dugon about the false widow spider, which also has a bit of a bite.
It has a nasty bite. Starting to get itchy.
It can get quite nasty, but we shouldn't think that it's too terrible either. For the false widow, nobody ever died, ever, but some people will actually develop symptoms when they get bitten that are more severe than the large majority.
Yeah, they will react badly to them. But in what circumstances would the false widow bite a human? Give me some examples, because so you saw one kind of...
Yes, it's actually quite typical. We have recorded bites so throughout the country, and the two main factors are actually when the spider is either stuck between the skin and the bed sheet, when the person is in bed and just turning over and therefore squashing the spider, or when people put on their clothes in the morning, and the spider was actually resting in their clothes. The spider is actually trapped between the skin and the clothes, and therefore, in order to defend itself, because it thinks that it's dying, that it's going to be crushed, well, it will bite. So it's not a species that actually will seek human contact to actually bite you and try and drink your blood or anything like this. No, not at all. It's just when the spider feels really threatened, accidentally, it may bite.
Oh, that was Dr. Michelle Dugan with Brenda in for Ray on Wednesday. And just to finish off the yuck shudderitis of this portion, Ray returned on Thursday with this. Crawling right out of the radio and into your ear, because that's the sound of a cockroach. Back in a bit, if you haven't turned over, do enjoy your egg. Welcome back. On Wednesday, Sarah McInerney brought us a truly harrowing interview with Kathleen Chadha. In July 2013, her husband Sanjeev Chadha killed their two children, Owen aged 10 and Rory aged 5, before attempting and failing to take his own life.
So on the 28th, Sanj left, supposedly taking the boys to go bowling in Carlow. Now, the background was that he had recently been found out as having embezzled a large sum of money from our local community. So, as you can imagine, things weren't that easy at home, although we were trying to create some semblance of normality for the boys. But so that evening, he took the boys, nothing unusual in that. I went for a walk. It was during the summer. I was on holidays from work. The boys were on holidays from school. So and he, none of them ever came home again. So his intention, as I now know, was to take the boys, to take their lives. He made what I would call a very pathetic attempt on his own life at the time. He drove to Mayo, very close to Ballintubber Abbey. There's no connection with there. I don't know why he ended up there specifically, but he killed the boys somewhere during that night, probably somewhere around 5-6 o'clock in the morning, we think. He continued to drive around for some time after that with the boys. He had put them into the boot of the car, and he stopped to get petrol. He stopped for coffee. Unimaginable, really, that at that point he had the wherewithal to be able to do that. As I understand it, he heard one of the news reports that had gone out. The boys were actually one of the first cry alert cases here, or was the first cry alert case here in Ireland. Thankfully, every other child has come back to us since then. But he heard that alert and proceeded then to crash the car. He could have killed a pedestrian, a cyclist, another, he could have crashed into another car, anything. He phoned me himself and he said the boys are dead in the back. My first question had been, where are the boys? Are they okay? And he said, no, they're dead in the back. My presumption at the time had been that he would that they were probably stunned, or if he was okay, that they must be okay. But they weren't. So, as I say, he didn't even grant me the comfort or dignity of having somebody passing that information on that would have actually had a little bit more empathy with me. So.
Sanjeev Chadha was sentenced to life imprisonment. However, 3 weeks ago, Kathleen was informed her husband had applied for parole after serving just 7 years. Now, under a new parole bill, that time frame would have risen to 12 years. However, that bill has yet to be commenced, which means that Kathleen Chadha will have to write to the parole board to state her objections to her husband's release.
At the moment, I will have to write a submission to the parole board. So it goes via the Irish Prison Service to the parole board, stating why I feel he shouldn't be given parole at this time. I'm quite confident he won't get parole. It's only 7 years, and we know the average at this point is 19 years. So I'm quite confident of that. But I still have to go through the process, because I can't not go through that process, because no matter what, there's that tiny little part of me that will go, well, what if? So he gets to read my submission. he gets to read what I write. So in a way, am I writing to the parole board or am I writing to him? As I'm doing that, I've started it and it's almost complete.
And can I ask you, what will you say in it?
I will outline very in great detail what he did to Owen and Rory, basically. So the physical injuries that he inflicted on the boys, the fact that it came out of nowhere, the fact that he could have. I mean, one of the big things that the parole board are looking for is he a threat to society? I wouldn't have said he was a threat to anybody 7 years ago. But he had absolutely no thought for others, other road users, we'll say, on that day, let alone having carried out what he's done. But he doesn't. This is somebody that I now see as incredibly narcissistic. I'm using the word sociopath because that's the only word I can use to describe him. It was somebody that I loved, that I was married to, that I had two children with. And yet he hid this side of himself so cleverly.
So you have to write all this in a letter. You have to sit down. You have to revisit.
Revisit everything.
All of it.
All of it. And I have to make
know that he'll be reading it.
Yes.
And Sarah asked what might happen if and when he is eventually released.
You said that you're very hopeful or you're almost certain that he won't be released this time. But it will come up again and it will come up again. And he may be released.
And
how will you cope with that then?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I would, because my fear, one of my biggest fears is that I will end up bumping into him in Ballinkillen over the grave. I don't visit the grave that often, not because of that, but mainly because to me, the boys are not there and I actually get really angry when I go over there. I just feel frustrated. You're looking at a piece of land, a piece of ground and a headstone, and that frustrates me. But there is that fear that I or somebody close to me will end up, because I feel that he will feel entitled to go down there. And so there's a fear of bumping into him. There's a fear of meeting him. There's a fear that, and there's an anger that he will feel entitled and be supported in getting on with life. The average life sentence in Ireland is 20 years. Now, let's say he even said, does 25 years. He's still only in his 60s at that point. So that, he's still young enough to be engaging. He'll engage with people, with others. He'll have a life. Mm. It's not about vengeance and it's not about sort of locking the door and throwing away the key for me. But it is about justice and that he feels... And that the system is allowing him the right to consider leaving the walls, if you like, of a prison cell at the moment is beyond me. So I'm very scared for when that time comes. But I suppose I feel, I've got support and I'll have to deal with it when it happens.
Kathleen Chadha with Sarah McInerney on Wednesday. Janet Harbison and the Belfast Harp Orchestra with Amra, the Harper's Elegy from a Columban Suite, the very first musical choice of harpist, composer and sound artist Una Monaghan, who chatted to John Kelly on Lyric on the Sunday service. And when it comes to learning an instrument, harp beats fiddle every time.
I think we come in the back of a school or maybe an orchestra concert of some description in the back row, and all I could see was this big gold thing, but I could hear the noise.
Yeah.
So I said, "What's that?" And they said, "A harp." And I said, "All right." So maybe it's that I thought that's the noise that came out of it and kind of latched on to it at that point. But there wasn't one around, so Mammy kept saying, well, that's nice, here's a fiddle, or that's nice, here's a whistle. And it was only in 1992, when there was a big bicentenary of the Harp Festival in Belfast, that there was a week of lessons that a beginner could go to. Oh. It was run by Janet Harbison. And Mammy said, thanks be to God, we can get this child a harp. So I rented one then. Yeah, tiny wee rented Irish harp for that week. And then Ian Mulliart, who's a maker in Meath, gave a harp to be given to a beginner who showed promise at that festival, and that's how I got my first harp.
Wow. And did you take to it immediately?
Loved it.
Right.
Yeah, and I just haven't really stopped since.
And is it a complicated instrument to learn?
The thing with the harp is that you're not encouraged to develop good technique early on, because the instrument kind of plays itself. It's really hard to make a horrible noise on a harp. Like, if you're playing the fiddle, you've got issues there for a while in terms of getting tone.
Yeah.
And people around you have to put up with some awful noises before you'll get good ones.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a harp, as soon as you play that, you know, it sounds lovely. And so the problem with learning the harp is making yourself do it well whenever it already sounds good.
Ah, right.
And there was some ingenuity involved in getting that harp to music lessons.
Well, my harp lived in a sleeping bag for long enough because it came with no cover. So on the back, the shoulder of that harp, there's multiple sleeping bag zip marks. Still to now, etched into the wood. But after I started learning with Janet then, she lived in Hollywood, and we had no car at the time, so my auntie would come and pick up the harp at 8 a.m. on her way to work, leave it in the garden at Janet's house. Janet would come out and get it and bring it in when she got up.
She'd leave it in the garden?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just a wee short period of time between, because my auntie was going really early to work. And so that was brought in, and then the harp was in Janet's house for me to get a train from Belfast after school and have the lesson, and then we would get a train back with a hot sausage roll on the way home, which to me was the best part of the whole thing. And then my auntie would bring the harp home on the way home again.
And that is only a small flavour of the really wide-ranging conversation that went on between Una Monaghan and John Kelly on Lyric on Sunday. She stalked the Beach Boys. Listen back. On Thursday's drive time, there was a lot of the economic stimulus package, as you might expect. But in the middle of it all, there was Josephine Silo, who had just celebrated her 104th birthday, and she just recovered from COVID-19.
I'm an old woman. I don't mind if I have to die tomorrow.
But you've beaten enough different things now, frankly. War of Independence, Civil War, World War One, World War Two. It'd be a shame to have something like a virus come and take you now.
I don't know.
And what is the secret, please, or is there a secret, Josephine, to how it is that you get to be here at 104 sounding so hale and hearty?
I never married. I was the second youngest of six girls. I was working as a waitress all my life, and I was quite content and just lived it.
And is there anything else? Is there any other little secret that you're holding back on us?
Not at all. I was just a worker. No, I never drank or smoked, if that's anything.
And would you not be tempted, even at this stage now, to say, do you know what? I've been around long enough to indulge myself just a little bit.
Never thought of that.
A humdinger, that was Josephine Silo celebrating her 104th birthday with Philip Boucher Hayes on Drive Time. Back in a bit. Welcome back. We've all taken something of a bruising over the past while, and this so-called new normal is creating all kinds of difficulties for our heads. So keeping an eye on our mental health was a theme that cropped up on the radio last weekend. On Sunday with Miriam, former UK Labour spin doctor Alistair Campbell spoke about how the wealth in your wallet was scant protection against depression. And he also talked about the stigma that continues to surround mental health issues.
Do you think that mental health remains the last great taboo, Alistair?
Yeah, it is. It's much, much better than it was. But I'll give you an example. Fiona and I, when we were back in London recently, we went out for a walk and I was feeling... I was sometimes when I'm very depressed, I literally can't speak. I find it impossible to speak. I go I'm sure there's lots of Brexiteers who listen to me. I wish it was like that all the time. But we went to buy some fruit and to the fruit stall that we always go to, and we normally have a bit of a laugh and a bit of a chat and, you know, football and politics and whatever. And I just wasn't in the mood, and so I was just standing there holding the dog, and I wasn't speaking. And Fiona said to the guy, the guy said to Fiona, "What's wrong with him then?" And she said, "Oh, he's got a really bad depression at the moment." And the guy said, "What's he got to be depressed about? You've got a great life." And of course, that is still an attitude. People almost think that if you've got a decent living, if you've got a nice house, if you've got a nice family, if you've got nice holidays, if you can do the things you want to do with your life, then why would you get depression? And of course, it's not like that. It's not a lifestyle choice. It's an illness. And I also think that in the health, I met somebody a couple of years ago now in the health service, a nurse, who told me that she was bipolar. She'd never admitted it. She wouldn't dare admit it because she was convinced that if she admitted it to her employers, that would be the end of any promotion prospects for her. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what she thinks.
Alistair Campbell with Miriam O'Callaghan on Sunday. And the previous day, rugby commentator Brent Pope had spoken to Brendan O'Connor about the shyness and anxiety he felt, something perhaps that was at odds with his public persona.
Shyness is interesting, though.
Yes, it's a form of anxiety.
Most adults don't kind of talk about shyness. It's regarded as something that, you know, kids have or whatever, or that you might have.
You
never outgrew the shyness despite, you know, people will be surprised that here's a guy who's well able to, very articulate, able to come in here and talk now, but you're still shy.
Yeah, I would be still shy. And that's where the judgment comes in, and that's where the kind of, suddenly if you think that you've gone into a room or something like that and you've been quite quiet and people don't expect you to be quiet because you've just been on the TV the day before arguing with George or doing something like that, they don't see it like that. So suddenly they can think, oh, well, you know, he doesn't have enough time for me, he doesn't have enough, you know, if you refuse to take a photo out there or something because you're arrogant
and you're aloof and all those things.
Oh, who does he think he is or something like that, you know, and I had to stop myself going on, you know, social things and that, because I was scared of what people would say about me, you know, and you know, people need to realize that, you know, that's one part of my life, and the other part is being someone that isn't as overly confident as people might look on the outside, you know, because I've had a life of, in a sense, I'm not saying masking it falsely, I am who I am, and I'm proud. Have I got to the situation I'm actually proud of who I am? And even when I talk about my own mental health journey, not yet, Brendan. You know, I'm not yet. I can't look back on my achievements, which have been many for other people. I can't look back on them now and say, okay, that was a brilliant, you know, that I did brilliantly at that. I need it to propel me to the next step or the next step on the ladder to say, okay, what am I going to do now? And that's all part of learned experience, that I step out of my comfort zone.
And Brent talked about the real need to, yes, make a living. But in his case, the real priority was to give something back.
Like a lot of people, I've had a close look at my life introspectively over COVID. And I'm saying, you know, I'm at an age, where do I want to be in 5 years? You know, where do I see that?
And what do you want now?
Giving back is a huge part of my life, and I'm not saying that just as a sap, you know, but it was a huge part of my father's life, and I'm trying to come up with how I can give back more. Now, I know I do a lot through the mental health and work with a lot of charities and that, but I would really like to work in that field of giving back. So I love that feeling I get when hopefully I change lives somewhere. Like I just... That feeling keeps me going. I mean, there's no greater feeling on the inside for me, and it's emotional for me to even say it now, is when people come up after they've heard me speak or do something and they come up and they grab your hand or whatever, pre-COVID days, obviously, and just say, Brent, you helped change my life, whatever that was. Man, you know, what a feeling to have. Nothing on the rugby field or nothing I've ever done on TV could ever compare to that feeling that you've got, that you've helped someone in your life. It's less about material goods now. It's more about you know, emotional goods?
It's funny, you know, we were told all the time in a way by society that if you look after yourself and look for things for yourself and all of that, that it'll make you happy. It never does, but we keep doing it anyway.
Absolutely.
And we're told if you do stuff for other people, it will actually make you happy. And we kind of go, yeah. And when we do it, we get a great buzz out of it, but we still are stuck on the other thing a bit, aren't we? Like,
yeah. That's so wise, man. It's incredibly wise.
Oh, stop now.
We're coming out of this COVID, okay, yes, you know, in a financial terms, well down economically, all those things we know. But maybe, just maybe, we're coming out as a kinder culture of people.
Brent Pope with Brendan O'Connor on Saturday. Now, swift gear change to the island of Descahal.
The Olympia and the cling film. Tell us about that.
Absolutely, tootly, we want to hear that one. Cling film. Here's Keith Barry.
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago now, but basically every night I was getting tied to a chair with 100 foot of rope by two random audience members, and then they got to wrap my head with a roll of cling film. The idea being that if I didn't get out of the rope and the cling film in less time that they tied me up in, I'd give them 500 euros each. So the idea of two people winning that money used to encourage them to really tie me up very tightly. And this one particular night, two guys came up, they tied me up really tightly. And of course, you have to get your hands free first. I mean, that's kind of essential. And this one night, I was having problems getting my hands free. So I kicked over the chair and I went back and I winded myself and I went to breathe in. And of course, I breathed in basically a whole load of cling film and I just passed out on the stage. And the next thing I remember is kind of coming to backstage and the shutter of the Olympia coming down. And it was one of the, I suppose, the more risky moments in my life, because if my team didn't come out and rip the cling film off my head, I think the results could have been far worse, you know.
No rabbits out of hats there, I tell you. Anyway, we do love the music here on this island, but whether or not we love it enough to give our musicians and the music industry a decent living, well, that's another thing. Mary Coughlan spoke to Ray Darcy about the stark reality of making music in the Spotify era and with the lockdown.
I'm speaking today, and I did speak at the weekend on behalf of the Music and Entertainment Association of Ireland, which was set up 3 weeks ago. We're at a very strange place. Indeed, most of your listeners probably don't know, but that anybody in a good situation like myself who does get Spotify plays, I receive 0.1 of a cent for a play. You know,
how many plays would you get in a year? I suppose people would want to be interested to know that as well, wouldn't they?
I got a 299-page royalty statement at the end of last year, from places from Arizona to Zambia to Russia. Yeah. I got 29 euros.
29 euros for a year of plays?
Yeah, on Spotify. But then the government in each individual country takes away the tax as well that they are entitled to take from your 0.01 of a cent.
And in common with many people, her COVID payment has gone from 350 euros a week to 203. And despite Mary Coughlan's long career and success, her annual income is a lot less, I suspect, than you might think.
People think because you're in the public eye a lot. Even people in our group would have thought that I probably make an average of 30 grand a year or less, you know.
I think people will be shocked by that, Mary.
Well, I swear to God it's true.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's not true, but as
but
you
I
say,
manage fine on that. I manage fine on that, Ray. I pay my mortgage and all my bills on that. Yeah. I manage fine on that.
No, but
like, that's what I earn.
But you are in the public eye, and you know, you're a sort of a national treasure. We love to see you coming in here, and people would assume, they just would assume that you earn more than that.
They would assume, they would assume that, but I don't. And
okay.
there are a lot of people. My musicians who are the finest band of musicians I've played with in many a year are reduced now. Two people I know have gone to live at home again, and some of the guys are sharing accommodation. And with the 203 reduced to, with their 350 reduced to 203, they have 40 euros a week to live on.
Right.
After they paid their share of the rent and their share of the bills, you know.
Yeah.
And by the time you buy a small bit of shopping and pay for your phone, you can't really.
No.
Mary Coughlan with Ray Darcy. And that view was echoed by singer Gavin James when he spoke to Oliver Callan on Thursday. Now, he'd planned a series of drive-in gigs, but they've now been cancelled to comply with new government guidelines. And he was gutted.
If there was no COVID-19,
yeah,
what would you have been doing now or preparing to do?
I think we would have been all over the gaff. It would have been, I think there's about 20 or 30 kind of gigs happening over the summer, and then it would have been a tour. And then I think everybody, I mean, to be honest, I was very lucky that I got to finish my tour in February. But the summer, obviously, everybody kind of lost out festival-wise, like Picnic, everybody kind of. So it's this was the whole idea, was just like an incentive to kind of, just like a stopgap to kind of get something happening in the music industry, because there's nothing other than live streams. And but it's just, it's, there's no end in sight, which is kind of, it kind of sucks for the likes of Mitex and Dan McKenney, to everybody's, to people who work with these bands for years and have been at work since March. And this was kind of the start of something that could have been bigger and other people could have jumped on. And obviously me doing my 12 gigs is not going to make a big dent in the industry at all. It would just would have helped.
Yeah, it would have been something, wouldn't it?
Would have been something. It would, the security guard that went to the gig, the person moving the cars, the person saying, even the toilets, there was like, everybody was allocated their own toilet square and everything. And it was like, it was so well thought out. Like everything was so well thought out in every way. It was like so safe. But now obviously, if there is a pandemic going on, so obviously the measures, like if they weren't safe enough, then it's totally understandable. It's more that there's no funding from the government right now for the AIST, which is the, which is pretty much all the techs and the front of house and the promoters and the booking agents that aren't really being looked after at the moment. So
Gavin James with Oliver, We Will Rock Again, hopefully soon. But as best they can, musicians are performing, but online and to empty auditoriums. So how do you sing your heart out without that crucial human element, the audience? Zambian-born Limerick hip-hop artist Denise Chyla spoke to Sean Rocks on Arena.
You've had this experience of sending out a performance with not necessarily, well, certainly no live response coming back. What does it feel like?
Well, I think it feels like an extension of a conversation with yourself in the shower for me. You know, because your music, or my music rather, is written and made with a few friends and kind of in isolation anyway. And so the joy of performance really is about entering into a conversation with people where you can see like visceral change, and they communicate with you what they're feeling as you share. And I think there's an intimidating thing about sort of hitting a blank wall and being afraid that it's just going to fall on deaf ears because you don't have the same connection. And for me, it was like a double-edged sword. I mean, on one hand, perhaps I rely too much on the responses of others to make me feel safe and secure in that. And so it taught me something, because of course music is such a vulnerable thing, right? Like you bare yourself before the world and you say, hey, this is what I'm giving, this is what I'm speaking, this is me. I wrote these in the privacies and the intimacies of my contained space, and I get to share that knowing that I am safely held by your attention.
Denise with Sean Rocks on Arena on Wednesday. Well, we are almost at a finish here on Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And in case you're wondering how to say Denise's surname, and you will in a minute, it's Chyla.
I do what I want with my pronouns. Keep it low-key on my profile. I raise the bar when I come through. You already know it's gonna go down. My name's not that hard to pronounce. Pre-K, it's not profound. C-H-A-I-L-A. Sound the words out. It's not Chile, it's not Chilala. Not a hard pill to swallow. Chile or Chilea, Chia, Chila, Dilla, that's not my name. Say my name. I've got drive, don't need gas. I wanna go far, not go fast. Chemical X when I power up. Turn back now, hard pass. I don't go Dutch when I checkmate. I keep the banner on my chest plate. All these takes so lukewarm, you should just say it with your chest, mate. It's not Chile, it's not Chilala. Not a hard pill to swallow. Chile or Chilea, Chia, Chila, Dilla, that's not my name. Say my name. Broke cycles every time that I spoke, so I took the training wheels off. Tour de France, cover new ground for all the hope the pain cost. not all who wonder lose their faith, and not all who wonder are lost. I know my heart and I know my name and I know the path that I walk. I work this hard so I can harvest, won't pick my fruit from the low branches. I don't know you man, but I know dancers. Free the journey, who's gonna stop this? I don't need gifts if you look musky, stay philanthropist. Don't need your concern if you'll look at me and see a troper kid. Go on luck like Dirk, don't care what you heard. My word is my bond and my name is my word. The soul of my world, and it's not Chile, it's not Chilala. Not a hard pill to swallow. Chile or Chilea, Chia, Chila, Dilla, that's not my name. Say my name. C-H-A-I-L-A-C-H-A-I-L-A-C-H-A-I-L-A-C-H-A-I-L-A-C-H-A-I-L-A-C-H-A-I-L-A-C. I do what I want with my pronouns. Keep it low-key on my profile. I raise the bar when I come through. You already know it's gonna go down. My name's not that hard to pronounce. Pre-K is not profound. C-H-A-I-L-A sound the words out. It's not Chile, it's not Chilala. Not a hard pill to swallow. Chile or Chilea, Chia, Chila, Dilla, that's not my name. That's not my name. Say my name.